Hey, Rowdy Mysterioso's here. Well, maybe we better be normal and play the intro.
Interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
It's Radio Mysterioso here for July, I think it's the 14th. 14th? Oh my God, it's the 17th. I'm glad I'm not paying rent today. As promised today, we have a guest, a guy I've known for a long time, Norio Hayakawa. He's still running the Civilian Intelligence Network. And I've actually known him since, oh my God, probably since the 80s or something. Just a second, let me hook him in here. Norio, can you hear me?
Yes, I sure can.
Excellent. Actually, Norio lives in Albuquerque right now after being in a few other places in the United States since he's been here for many years, which we'll talk about. And people may not know that he organized the first and only Dulce Underground Base Conference 2 years ago, and we'll talk about that too. Norio, how are you?
Very good, Greg. Thank you so much for having me on your program. I actually live right next to Albuquerque, and the city's name is Rio Rancho, a relatively new city located right next to Rio Rancho, a little closer, to Santa Fe or even to Dulce.
Yeah, by about, what, maybe 10 or 15 miles?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's a little bit north of Albuquerque. Well, I just say Albuquerque because I guess people mostly know where that is. But yes, that's Rio right. Rancho. Actually, you live quite near somebody some people might know listening to the show. You live quite near Gabe Valdez, right?
Yeah, I think I can get to his house in about 15 minutes or 20 minutes the most.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought you were closer there. Because the conference that Nancy Wallace put on recently, that was near you, right?
Exactly. I was only about, I'm only about 10 minutes away from the Santa Ana Star Casino.
Yeah. It was a conference that Nancy Wallace put on. Pretty good one. I mean, there were a few people that I really wanted to hear, like specifically Richard Dolan and Colin Andrews, I believe.
Yes, it was a very interesting conference, and it was the first conference of its kind ever to be held in Albuquerque, a city that definitely should have more such conferences, you know, for many reasons.
Yeah. I mean, it's a place where you can get the attendance, I think. It's kind of like L.A. or San Francisco or sort of western cities where people, I think, are more interested in these kind of things and UFOs, et cetera, New Age stuff, if you want to call that. Norio, you were born in Japan, yes?
Yes, I was actually born in Japan, raised in the city of Yokohama. I was actually born in 1944. And I was raised there. I went to an American school over there, from grade school on all the way to high school. And after I graduated from that high school, I decided to study in the United States, and I researched everything about colleges in the United States, and somehow I chose New Mexico.
to go to school, or you mean to end up at where you are now?
Yeah, I think it's maybe it's destiny. I was very interested in New Mexico because I was definitely interested in studying the Spanish language as spoken in northern New Mexico, which has the one of the most unique kind of archaic Spanish language.
That dialect?
Spoken.
You mean a dialect that's been there since colonial Spanish time?
That's right.
Okay, but what's interesting, I saw you speak at the ASPE conference that Nancy, oh, what's her name? Do you remember her name?
Janet Saylor.
Janet, that's right. I'm sorry. Nancy Wallace was is Albuquerque. Yeah, Janet Saylor. I saw you speak there a couple years ago, and you gave us a biography, and I didn't know a lot of this stuff about you, when you'd moved to the United States and how you started out in Los Angeles and eventually moved to Arizona and then to New Mexico.
That's correct. And, you know, I have been here since 1965, actually. That was the year when I came to Albuquerque, New Mexico, for the first time. This was my first trip ever abroad, Japan, you know, from Japan. And I fell in love with New Mexico and Albuquerque, and you know, that was in 1965. I became fascinated with New Mexico and the Southwest. I moved to Arizona, and then finally to California, and it was in Arizona in 1976 that I decided to apply for citizenship, and 1976 was the 200th anniversary of the founding of this amazing country, and I decided to become a United States citizen, and I never regret this because I'm glad to be part of America, and I'm glad to be an American, and I'll die for this country.
Well, I thought the other thing that was interesting was your first job in L.A., and then which I will let you talk about, and then you when you moved to Phoenix, I think it was, you said you were teaching Spanish to white people, which I thought was pretty funny.
Exactly. I was teaching high school Spanish to Anglo ranchers and also Mexican immigrant children. And here I was, a Japanese guy, teaching Spanish, beginning Spanish to these folks.
What was your job when you were in L.A.?
Well, in L.A., I was looking for a job, and I looked all over, and I went to an employment office, and I was desperate to get a job, a decent job, and but anyway, I went to the employment office, and they sent me to this company in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it was a funeral home, a Japanese funeral home.
Where was it exactly?
It was just a mile from Little Tokyo in the industrial area, and it was one of the two Japanese-American-owned funeral homes in the United States. And this one was in the Little Tokyo section of Los Angeles. And I got this job not knowing exactly what a funeral home does. And anyway, they let me stay in the second floor to just answer phones from night. And I was the only person living there upstairs at night.
How fun.
Yes, and of course downstairs were usually about 25 or 26, 27 persons sleeping in a morgue.
Yeah, sleeping peacefully. And I will bet nothing strange ever happened while you were there.
Well, actually, I was, first of all, I was really spooked in the first few days. And
yeah.
But anyway, I got used to so much after months of doing that. And it came to a point where I could actually go downstairs to the morgue at around 2 o'clock in the morning and turn on a TV inside a morgue and watch, you know, a Dracula movie and still not be afraid. Or playing a music in the morgue and practicing a karaoke.
Oh, really? You were singing in the middle of the night with all the in the middle of the morgue?
Yeah, that's right, because I was the only person there at night, and, you know, it was very quiet. Nobody complained.
Of course not.
And I think maybe they might have even enjoyed it.
Yeah, if they had complained, you would know you were really bad at it. singing so badly to wake the dead, which I have heard. And I have actually heard Norio's music, which I do like. And it turns out we have some similar musical tastes, which we'll talk about later. So you left Japan just because you were so interested in the U.S. and southwestern U.S. and the Spanish language. I didn't know you had those interests before you even came over here.
Yes, that was the main interest in my life, is to be able to master the Spanish language and also to study the unique Spanish spoken in northern New Mexico villages. And this is the only place in the world right now that you can actually listen to the archaic Spanish forms that were spoken by the Spanish soldiers when they conquered the Southwest, you know. You can hear, you know, a little bit of the Don Quixote style Spanish.
The Castilian?
Yeah, it's a Castilian, but actually it's more like a countryside Spanish spoken by the country folks and soldiers. See, because the first Spanish, what they call conquistadores.
Yeah.
Came, they were soldiers, and they didn't come from they didn't speak, really high-class Spanish, so to say.
Yeah.
But they used a lot of archaic words and farmer words, and their pronunciation was, a little different. So this is the only place in the world where you can still hear this kind of Spanish. So it's a fascinating location. So that was my main interest in coming here, and I eventually became a Spanish high school teacher, as I mentioned to you. And then, you know, I started teaching in Arizona. But I've done so many things in my life, Greg. At one point in time, I decided to quit everything, and I joined a country western band in Arizona.
That's cool.
And traveled, the Nevada and Arizona, and even went to Canada, because I joined a band, led by a Cherokee guy by the name of Johnny White Cloud.
Uh-huh.
And I was a lead guitarist in that band, and, it was a very interesting time in my life.
I hear these things about you, and most people know you as that guy that's interested in UFO stuff and underground bases and all that. Not many people know about this other part of your life, which is, it's like three or four other people's lifetimes. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, and somehow all of these things seem to have some interrelationship, because being a funeral director for so many years, I've been doing the, I was a licensed funeral director for almost 25 years in Los Angeles. And it was one of the best careers that I had. And I joined, I enjoyed this work, because you learn about life and you learn about death, and you learn that they are both interconnected. And it's an amazing thing. I never regret that I became a funeral director. But anyway, I retired, of course, in 2008, and moved to New Mexico, as I told you before.
Yeah.
Yes, so I'm now retired, and I have plenty of time. I do a lot of volunteer work in New Mexico here.
I
play music in senior centers and community centers and even hospitals, and you know, I volunteer all of this, and then once in a while I give some lectures about UFOs.
Well, that's the next part of the talk here. I was wondering how you first became interested in this stuff. Was it when you were in Los Angeles, or where was it, and how did that happen? I mean, did you see something, or did you read something, or?
Well, you know, I was in Japan in 1964. And because I came to the United States in 1965, but in 1964 I was still in Japan, and I was you know, an interpreter at the Olympic Games over there in Tokyo.
Oh.
But in 1964 I also had a fascinating encounter, and that is to say, in April 28th or 24th, I'm not sure, of 1964, I read an interesting article in a Japanese newspaper. It was an English newspaper published in Japan, and the headline said, "Officer sees saucer sitting on sand," and dated April 24, I believe, 1964, and from Socorro, New Mexico.
Ah.
That article really, really, you know, made me curious. And that was a year before I came to Albuquerque, by the way. So, you know, nothing is coincidental. I came to New Mexico mainly because I wanted to learn Spanish. But the bonus was that there was something going on in New Mexico besides.
Oh, so you came to New Mexico, well, partly because of the Spanish and also because of the Socorro incident.
That's correct. That really impacted my, you know, outlook on life. Even though I had been interested in flying saucers in the early 1960s, you know, probably 1961 or 1962, when I was in high school, because my father, now deceased, of course, my father used to tell me about his sighting of a strange object in the Bay of Yokohama around 1947 or 1948 while he was night fishing. He told us, the family, my sister and my mother, that he saw this strange object flying over the Bay of Yokohama around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And he used to tell me that story, and but anyway, so when I was growing up, you know, I knew that something about flying saucers, and I became interested. So, yeah, but what really made me really get serious was the 1964 Socorro incident. But, of course, before that, I did join some flying saucer organizations in Japan, I think in 1962 or something. But here comes this amazing incident in 1964 that really, you know, put the nail on the, you know, really made me think seriously about it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's background noise here. I don't know if you can hear it. My studio here is above an extremely busy street, so sometime during the show there will be sirens and you will hear them very clearly.
Very good.
Did you so when you got here, you already had an interest in UFOs and strange phenomena, I guess. How did that develop? I mean, I think you're probably one of the go-to people on not only UFO stuff, but basically government and UFO stuff. And we'll get into that kind of heavily too, because you and I have a lot to talk about regarding that. But how did you get interested in more interested in it, and maybe more specifically the government connection?
Well, actually, after I came to Albuquerque to study Spanish at this college in Albuquerque, I got to know a few people who said they worked at the Sandia Laboratories.
Ah.
And they used to tell me that there is a mountain that is partially hollow, and it's called Manzano Mountain, or Manzano Mountain, right next to the Kirtland Air Force Base.
Yeah.
And they told me that they store some very sensitive nuclear materials and, weapons. And so, yeah, I was very interested in that, too. So my college, friends used to tell me that. So naturally, I got more interested in UFOs. I also became friends in college with students who lived in Roswell and who came to study in Albuquerque. So they were my classmates. So they all told me a lot of things, interesting things. So my interest in UFOs really picked up, while I was in college. The college was called the University of Albuquerque, which doesn't exist anymore, but...
Was this late 60s?
Yes, this was 1965, 1966,
oh, okay.
1967.
Yeah.
While I was in college, I read many news articles about the UFO flap, or actually it was a wave of sorts in 1966, 1967 in Michigan and all other parts. There was a huge wave, I think. And that further interested me. And, of course, during the 60s and the early 70s, I was very, very interested in UFOs as extraterrestrial spacecraft. So I was a tremendous supporter of the extraterrestrial hypothesis of UFOs. But anyway, when I moved to Arizona, in 1973,
uh-huh.
Yes, when I moved to Arizona in 1973, I began to teach in a country high school, outside of Phoenix. And as I told you before, half of the students in this high school were Anglo-Saxon white,
yeah.
Children of the ranches, and the other half were Mexican farm workers' children.
Huh.
But anyway, that was 1973, and as I soon began to teach the Spanish to these students, I also began to read so much about the October of 1973. There was a humongous wave of UFO sightings all across the United States in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
In October. So, I kept holding on to the extraterrestrial hypothesis of the origins of UFOs because I was convinced at that time that these were extraterrestrial entities in extraterrestrial craft observing us and so on. And so that was in the early 70s. I kept my view that way till the late 70s when I began slightly changing my position or my beliefs.
What made you start changing your mind?
Well, because in 1978, I think it was around that time, I began to read some books written by people like Jacques Vallée.
Oh, yeah.
And people like John A. Keel, they opened my eyes very much. And I slowly began to entertain the thought that maybe, just maybe, these so-called UFOs may not necessarily be extraterrestrial intelligence with extraterrestrial physical spacecraft. I began to entertain the possibility that maybe there could be other alternative explanations. So since 1978, I became a supporter of what's known as the extra-dimensional origins of the these so-called visitors. But and then, you know, I kept this on all the way till when I came to Los Angeles to become funeral director. You know, I told you that in 1982, I was looking for a job, and finally I ended up becoming a funeral director in Los Angeles from 1982. And, you know, in 1988, something changed my life again. Well, I was a funeral director, of course. I received a strange letter from John Lear, personally, in 1988. Hmm. And before that, I was watching a TV special program, Fox TV special, called UFO Cover-Up Live. I think that was broadcast in 1988 in October.
Yes.
And that was a two-hour, very, very fascinating program. I don't think that kind of a program will ever be broadcast in the United States, but this two-hour program opened my eyes in the sense that they mentioned that there is a secret facility in Nevada called Area 51, and that was the first time I ever heard of it. But the coincidence is that I did receive a letter in the same year from John Lear talking about Area 51. And Dulce, by the way. And it was also the time when I received a packet from William Moore.
And, you got some stuff from Moore?
Pardon?
I said you got some stuff from Moore?
Yes.
Huh, I didn't know that.
William Moore sent me a 12-page packet personally. He sent me this Soviet satellite of Area 51, and he basically sent me other information telling that there is a very fascinating facility in Nevada. And so both from John Lear and William Moore, I began to get the sense that there was something going on in Nevada, and it was in 1989 that when I was working, of course, at Mortuary, I was listening one night to a radio station that was broadcast from Las Vegas, and this was KVEG AM radio station.
Yes.
That you can get from in Los Angeles too. You know, it was a powerful station. And I was listening one night, and there was this talk show, and on this talk show was a gentleman who claimed to have worked at a secret facility in Nevada. And of course, this was Bob Lazar, by the way.
And, I think that was Billy Goodman's show.
It was a Billy Goodman show.
Yeah.
It was a Billy Goodman show. I got so hooked up in that show, I listened to him almost every night. And I became so fascinated with Bob Lazar's story that I actually wrote a letter to a Japanese magazine called MU, M-U. You know, just like the
Lost Continent.
Yes, that's right. That was a popular Japanese magazine that dealt with all kinds of interesting phenomena throughout the world. And I wrote to them that there is a gentleman on the radio that says that there is a secret base and that he is working, or he worked in the reverse engineering of a spacecraft from another world. And that really fascinated me. So when they read my letter, this Japanese magazine, they became interested and said, can we, get in touch with this guy in Nevada? So I said, I'll try. So anyway, to make a long story short, the Japanese magazine decided to send not only a writer from that magazine, but also several crew of a Japanese television company called Nippon Television Network.
Yeah, NHK.
Well, actually, it's not NHK.
Oh, really?
Because NHK is a government sponsored.
Yeah, it's a government one, yeah.
Yeah, network. But this Nippon Television Network was a regular commercial popular station. And so it was in 1990 that they came to Los Angeles. And, of course, before the Japanese TV came here to see me, they actually did their own groundwork, and I think they communicated with Gene Huff or somebody, and somehow they got in touch with, you know, they got in contact with this Bob Lazar. And so anyway, in February of 1990, Nippon Television crew and the writer and I drove all the way from Los Angeles to Las Vegas and went to Mr. Lazar's residence.
Ah.
That was, yes, February the 21st of 1990. And we interviewed him for about 3.5 hours at his home.
Hmm. Somebody told me. Oh, go ahead.
And that was one of the most interesting interviews I ever participated in. I was basically, you know, trying to interpret for these Nippon Television crew and this writer.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was a fascinating interview because Mr. Lazar welcomed us to his home, and there was, I think there was Mr. Gene Huff there, and there were about three or four other men there. No women, only men. And anyway, you know, we did the interview. Mr. Lazar sat on a couch, and there were two gentlemen that sat alongside with him.
Huh.
And, you know, the interview went, you know, as I said, 3.5 hours, basically. And but we had to take breaks. You know, he had to get a drink at the kitchen water or something. But we noticed that every time he stood up, these two persons seemed to go with him. And, you know, so at first it didn't bother us, but later on we started getting kind of weird. You know, we had a weird feeling, and I asked Mr. Lazar, please, Mr. Lazar,
Are these your friends?
And Mr. Lazar said, oh, don't worry, they are my friends. But something didn't seem really natural to me.
Yeah, obviously.
And, yeah, and also we noticed that one of these guys, had a black rectangular equipment on his belt, and it wasn't a cell phone, by the way. This was in 1990, and it was much, much larger than a cell phone. It was a rectangular box on his belt. So I didn't know what to think of it, but, you know, this interview was fascinating. And at the end, Mr. Lazar said he will not go with us to this location, where he told us that there would be some testing of this craft that he was talking about. So he just told us exactly where to go, and so the TV network and the crew and the writer and I drove, you know, 2 hours from Las Vegas and went to the Highway 370, Highway 375, and 29.5 mile marker point, and you know, there's a dirt road going south, and from there you can see the Groom Mountains or the jumbled hills that you know, cover the Area 51 area. So we set up the TV cameras, and these were professional quality cameras. And Mr. Lazar had told us before at his residence that after sundown, we will definitely see some craft that will do some, you know, maneuvering, you know. So, lo and behold, after we set up the camera after sundown, the first brilliant light appeared above the jumbled hills, you know, beneath behind Area 51. And it rose up, and then it turned to the right, and it made some interesting maneuver because it descended real quick and then ascended so quick, almost like a very, you know, straight turn, you know. And we were very impressed with that. And it it did the maneuvering for about, I think, 45 seconds. And then later, 15 minutes later, another one came up, different one, or could be same one or different one, I'm not sure, an orange light that did a similar kind of a maneuver. And then about 20 minutes later, the last one came up. And so we were all impressed with this, and the Nippon Television crew caught this bright object. And, of course, you know, this turned into a two-hour program that was broadcast in 1990 in March in Japan. And I think probably about 30 million people in Japan watched that program. It's a two-hour program called, basically called The Mystery of Area 51 and Dulce, New Mexico. Because after, you know, coming back to Las Vegas, we flew to Albuquerque. And we started interviewing some people in Dulce, New Mexico. So, you know, this program, two-hour program, dealt with both Area 51 and Dulce, New Mexico, during the time when most people in America didn't have any kind of a slightest idea of Area 51.
Yeah.
Of course, Area 51 in 1989, of course, only basically the people in Las Vegas and Nevada had heard about it because they watched the George Knapp's, you know, interview with Lazar and so on. But overall, in the entire country of the United States, Area 51 was not a household word yet at that time.
Listening to this, this is a fascinating story, Nora, because I'd never heard this. And I knew that a Japanese TV crew had come and that you had talked to them. And there's so many questions that come up here. And the first one, I think, was what did you think? In retrospect now, who do you think these guys were that were at Lazar's house hanging out with him?
Well, I still don't know exactly. I have no idea who they were, and could be anything. It could have been my, you know, misinterpretation of what these people were, but it didn't seem right to me. And the second thing was that his house didn't look like it was lived daily. Like, you know, there was sparse furniture in the house, you know, just very, very sparse. And there was a study room, and there was a, you know, computer, I think two or three computers in that study room, and only few books on a bookshelf. And some books, I think it had to do with physics. But anyway, it was not kind of a house that you feel like Bob Lazar was living every day, you know, for years in that house. It didn't seem like it. Seemed to me that it was hastily set up.
Yeah.
For the interview, but you know, I could be wrong in this, but that was the impression I got at that time.
Bill Moore sent you information about Area 51 when? In 1988, you said.
It was in 1988 because somehow I heard about Mr. William Moore because he, I think he was giving a lecture at somewhere, I remember. And I didn't go to the lecture, but I somehow found his mailing address, and I requested him for some information, and he sent
me a
12-page packet. Later on, I actually attended a couple of his lectures. I attended Bill Moore's lecture once or twice in Los Angeles. I forgot exactly where. I think it's in the San Fernando Valley. And in 1988, I think, if I recall, I attended a lecture given by a researcher at a residence in Los Angeles, and his name was Bill Steinman.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I went to this house because a friend said there's an interesting guy that's going to speak at this house. And when I went to the house, it was packed. And that was Bill Steinman.
That wasn't Gary Schultz's place, was it?
No, it was some other person's house. And
oh, okay.
The interesting thing about the Bill Steinman was, of course, I didn't pay too much attention to his book.
Yeah, UFO Crash at Aztec was his book.
Yes, but in the 90s, I started reading his book, and I was impressed by the fact that he did mention Area 51 in that book, a couple pages, and I think Dulce was mentioned, I think, once or twice in that thick book. But, you know, all of this fascinated me. But what really made me interested in all of this was the, 1990, February the 21st experience at, Highway 375 and mile marker 29, where we saw this strange lights, the very spot that Bob Lazar told us that we would see. So, you know, that was the beginning of my deep interest in Area 51. And, of course, at that time, I began to change my perspective a little bit. I was impressed initially about these maneuvering of these objects, but later on, I began to think that maybe, just maybe, these were not alien spacecraft, but these could be just United States technology. And so in the early 90s, I became an activist about Area 51 because I became more and more convinced that it was the government that was doing all this kind of things, and the alien thing was just a smoke screen.
Right. I remember that you were involved with people like Schultz and John Lear, I believe, who you've already mentioned, and trying to stop some sort of cover-up going on at Area 51, which I think the cover-up was basically black budget project aircraft, and maybe other things too, like projection of images somehow so that people could see them. When you say these people were hanging out with Lazar and the place looked like a set or that had just been hastily put together, the first thing I think of is somebody dearly wanted you to listen to Lazar, go out and see what he's showing you, have the stuff be shown to you, and have those rumors start. And that you know, if somebody didn't want anybody to hear about it, they would have never said anything, and Lazar never would have spoken, and you would have never gone out there with the TV crew and all these other things that happened at Area 51. And I get the impression, and I want to see what you think about this, because you were more heavily involved than I was at the time, that this was basically all staged so that UFO people and the international media and a few other people would come out and notice and would talk about it and would start the rumors about UFOs and all that.
I guess that's really, I think that's my conclusion, after all these years, when I, look back at things, I think that the use of the beliefs that there was something alien in Area 51 was, I believe, staged or manipulated or even spread by the Air Force as what now we call the laughter curtain. Because anybody that talks about Area 51 you know, actually, this is amazing because Area 51 is alien to a lot of people. And even if you talk to anybody in America and mention the word Area 51, the name Area 51, immediately they associate Area 51 with rumors of aliens or aliens.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I think it was a brilliant strategy by the defense groups, because I think many defense contractors have policies to create cover stories when interesting, you know, secretive projects.
Well, when I did research for Project Beta and talked to some of these counterintelligence people, one of whom is sitting here with us right now, Walter, I found and was confirmed for me by Bill Moore and other people, and people always say that I listened to Bill Moore, and how do I know he wasn't lying to me? Well, the point was, for a while he was a pretty good friend of mine, and I didn't ever find him to lie to me about anything that I could find, really. But what he said and what some of these other government contacts said was, we're not trying to make people believe a certain way about UFOs or, you know, stop people being interested in them. What we want to know is, at least that back then, and I think even in the 90s, was who was interested, why were they interested, and who were they talking to? And by spreading these stories and making people notice, people would get active and start talking on the phone and start coming out there with cameras and no email back then, but calling people and sending letters. And they could monitor all this stuff and see who was looking at the base. And like you said, it also throws a big laughter curtain over it, so people don't people that are serious about it will stay away. The only people that will be interested in it are, one, people who are paranoid and interested in UFO stuff, and two, foreign nationals who may want to find out these things, and to make things active like that, and to get them talking to each other and come out of their holes like that, they would do things like this, including what you experienced there at Area 51 with the crew and later. Would you agree with that?
I think, yes, I agree with that. You know, I think there's a big game that has been going on and will continue to go on. You know, this is part of, you know, their policies about UFOs and belief systems. But basically, in the back of my mind, I definitely am a kind of person that doesn't believe in, you know, creating dogmatic statements about anything. Because,
right.
You know, this whole UFO phenomenon, let's face it, is, to me, it's a real phenomenon, and people have reported strange things from time immemorial. So the phenomenon is real, and I agree 100% with people like Jack Vallee that the phenomenon is real, but yet we cannot make a hasty conclusion about this phenomenon. We have to keep researching. And, you know, that's what we have to do.
You can see why I'm interested in talking to Norio, because it's some of the things he's saying are things that I've said, and I was also heavily influenced by Vallee. Keel, people like Greg Little, Jim Brandon, other writers that only have written a couple of books, actually, about UFOs, but they basically all have the same idea, like you said, that it is a real phenomenon. People will use it for whatever reason that they want to promote any agenda. But the thing is that the phenomenon itself has been going on for so long, we can't really say that's made up by anybody, because it's just been around for so long. I don't think it's a delusion. But I think we put our own meaning on it in every generation, in every period of history, and even individually. You know, and Norio, I've talked about this before, I think, haven't we?
Yes, I think so. And this is why I say that, Greg, I think you're one of the most level-headed, you know, researcher, because you're open to any possibility without coming to a definite dogmatic conclusion about anything. And so I think that I also agree with your position. And so, you know, this whole phenomenon is just a fascinating subject matter. In fact, I think this is the most important subject matter, you know, that you can ever imagine. I think this is the most important subject because it involves everything about human nature and, you know, human philosophy and human psychology. Everything seems to be intertwined somehow with this phenomenon in some way.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it and there's elements of sociology, psychology, science, and basically I think how we look at ourselves. I think there's a lot going on here that we contribute without realizing, like a Rorschach blot, you know?
Yes, and this is why, you know, I think, my personal opinion is that the government is also perplexed about this phenomenon. And my personal opinion is that I don't think the government is trying to cover up anything because I think they themselves are perplexed with this thing for many, many years. The only reason they will not disclose their position is because if they disclose their position, all they can say is they don't even know what this phenomenon is, and that's not what the public wants. The public wants an answer, and I think the government is unable to answer to the public because this phenomenon goes way beyond just simple physical phenomenon that is explainable by empirical science. And so the government is not in the business of explain anything other than, you know, physical, empirical, you know, viewpoints.
Yeah, as you were saying this, and I, you know what, I pretty much agree with you, Norio, that it's the cover-up is ignorance, that, yes, they do know something's here. Yes, it is not human, and yes, it interacts with people, but no, they don't know where it comes from, really, and don't really know what to do about it. Walter does not agree with me, and he wanted to say something about it. You have not met Norio, although he's on the phone here. Walter, I talked about him earlier, Norio. It's Walter Bosley, who's on the show with me every once in a while. Actually, quite often.
Hello, Norio. Nice to meet you, finally.
Hello, Walter. Yes.
I'm in the minority here with you two guys. I just disagree that they, at least the way it was stated, that they, I think that they do know a lot more than that about them. They can't control them. Maybe, that I'll agree with, that whoever they are, wherever they're from, they pretty much do what they want. And certainly our silly governments, you know, are not going to control them. But I think they got a pretty good handle on who they are and where they're from, at least the ones that they're in contact with. I think if there's any kind of feigned ignorance going on, it's something I've discussed and others have discussed in the past, where I think they've handed over the custodianship of this issue to private companies, because private companies do not fall under disclosure laws and the public's right to know. So whereas the government, after a while, if the public demands it, freedom of information, the government has to give stuff up eventually to a great degree. But private corporations, that would be proprietary information, and they don't have to. And my guess, having worked in the system, is that it makes sense to me that they would have handed over the custodianship of the whole UFO question to a private entity for that reason. But I think they know where they're from, and I think they know a lot more. But you know, it's a whole other topic and can of worms as to why we're not told.
Did you hear all that, Norio?
Yes, I think I heard, what you were saying. Yes, I'm sure that the government knows more than what we imagine. I think the problem is how to, explain to the public. And, my feeling is that no government of the world will be the one to disclose anything. I think if disclosure is to come, I think it will come from the entities themselves at an opportune time.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, Norio, that's basically how I feel about it, too.
Yeah, that's unanimous here, yeah.
Yeah, my other 50% of that disclosure thing is when most people, or at least the segment of our society which tells us how to think, is able to comprehend what the phenomenon is. That might be the other side of it too, because if something, whatever it is, could say whatever it wants, but if we're not prepared and our minds can't get our minds around a certain concept of what these things are and how they interact with us, I don't think there's. It's kind of like it's like showing a dog a watch, and the dog can see the watch, but it doesn't know what the hell it does or what it's for. It's just this shiny thing, and I think that's what we think about UFOs right now. We think we've got an idea that they're people from other planets coming here in ships, but to my mind, that's so far away probably from what it is that we're not ready to comprehend it yet. And I'm not saying that to be, I'm smart or anything like that, but me too. I don't think I'm ready to comprehend it yet either, because our model of the world and reality, it does not include whatever these things are. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. We're so limited in our understanding of the cosmos, because we just can think in terms of our limited dimensionality, I think the more people that could change and be acceptable to other dimensions, the more people that have that kind of worldview, the increases, I think there is also a much larger chance in the near future when we're ready to be told or revealed by these entities, and then they may do so. People say that people like Dr. Michio Kaku believes in UFOs, but actually he does open up the possibility, and he says it's likely, but he doesn't himself make any dogmatic statements about the nature of UFOs. And I think this is just it's a fascinating subject that will go on for many more years to come unless we get disclosed by these entities.
Yeah, so it's not really in our hands, and it might not even be in the power structure's hands. Who knows? I wrote something down here, and I mentioned his name. Oh, but one other thing. The package you got from Bill Moore, did it talk about Area 51 specifically? In 1988, this was?
Yes. Actually, it was in 1988. And that's why I think that people have known about Area 51 without naming Area 51. Probably there were a lot of people who may have heard about that there is a base in Nevada, maybe even in the mid-80s. So, it's really not 1989 when Lazar came out that people began to hear about Area 51, but the name Area 51 had been going around in a limited, among a limited segment of the researchers as early as, maybe even the mid-80s.
Yeah, well, it starts to sound like damage control at that point when Lazar came out and the Billy Goodman show had him on and had the story on. It starts to sound like damage control on somebody's part, because a few people are starting to pay attention. So instead of denying everything, let's just pretend that there's somebody giving out information from the inside. While this is controlled the entire time, and people don't know this because they think it's some guy that's just leaking information. And as you say, and this fascinates me, that there were people there hanging around with him the whole time when he was talking to the news and talking to you. And then they direct you specifically out to a specific area that became famous later and tell you exactly when something's going to show up. Now, that doesn't sound very secret to me. It sounds like somebody is trying to make an impression upon you and anybody else who's paying attention in a certain direction.
Exactly. When I think of all of this thing, I think everybody has definitely some kind of destiny. In fact, I think it was my destiny to come to New Mexico in 1965. It was my destiny to, you know, move to Arizona and then later to Los Angeles. Anything that happens in our lives, I think, has a plan. And, of course, without sounding too religious, I believe that there's no such thing as a coincidence in our individual lives. And, you know, the very fact that I'm talking to you right now, Greg, and, you know, the very fact that we met, you know, in the first Dulce Underground Bass Conference in 2009, and, you know, and ever since, you know, I communicated with you, I think all of this thing is really not a coincidence. I think it could be something that is meant to be. And the fact that I received this, you know, five-page hypothesis from John Lear in 1988, who was a friend of a gentleman by the name of Tal Levesque.
Oh, yeah.
Or Jason Bishop.
no relationship.
Jason Bishop, yes. Jason Bishop befriended me in 1988. He used to come to my house in, you know, Gardena and many times. And he's the one who introduced me to John Lear. And John Lear is the one that sent me this, you know, I think it was, maybe it was longer, maybe it was a 7 or 8 page hypothesis about Area 51 in Dulce, New Mexico. So anyway, I was really fascinated, you know, because that was the first time I ever heard about Dulce, New Mexico. That was in 1988, even though many other people, especially in these people that were living in New Mexico, already had heard about the Dulce rumors in the early 80s, or maybe even in 1980. So, but it was only in 1988 that I personally heard about Dulce, New Mexico, strangely enough, at the same time as Area 51. So, to me, both Area 51 and Dulce came at the same time to my life.
Yeah, and it seemed like it was supposed to be at that point that these rumors started. And you do say that it probably was around since the early 80s. It was at least around since 86 or so when Paul Benowitz started talking about a Dulce base and about an underground base there and what was going on there. And his attention was drawn to that, just like you and the Area 51 people, by some Air Force people that took him there and told him something was there.
Yes, I think you're right. In fact, I think it was already in 1980 or 1981 that Paul Benowitz started suspecting that there was something in Dulce, New Mexico, because he got together with Myrna Hansen,
yeah,
who claimed to have been abducted in Cimarron, New Mexico. I think that was in 1980.
Yeah, 79 or 80, yeah.
Yes, and, you know, so Paul Benowitz is really the first main person to bring out Dulce, New Mexico, and without Paul Benowitz, I don't think there's no Dulce. And I agree with your very excellent work, Project Beta, Greg, that really, you know, I'm really impressed with your work, Project Beta, which I think is one of the best books ever written about the origins of the rumors of the Dulce base.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and so the importance of Paul Benowitz is very, very big. And, of course, the roles played by the Kirtland Air Force Base, I think, is also significant. And, of course, the, you know, OSI and so on, and their manipulation of everything in intermingling with Paul Benowitz, because Paul Benowitz lived right next to the Manzano nuclear storage, you know, area, and he had his business right next to the Kirtland Air Force Base.
Yeah, it's still there.
It's still there, and his sons are doing, I'm sure they're doing pretty good business, you know, with Kirtland. And so, of course, his sons refuse to talk about his father, of course, for, you know, that reason, that because they're doing business with the Kirtland.
Yeah, well, I didn't put it in the book, but I went to the Thunder Scientific unannounced, walked into the office in 2004, I think, and I think Brad, his son Brad, was there, and I asked him if he would talk to me about that period, and before I even finished the sentence, he said, no, absolutely not, we don't want to have anything to do with it.
Because that is really, I think, amazing. You know, I mean, their business is right next to the gate of the Kirtland Air Force Base, and I think part of that business is almost, you know, you can jump over the fence and get inside Kirtland Air Force Base. And, you know, from my understanding, Paul Benowitz's wife still lives in the house right by the Manzano area, you know, on Fort Hills. And I think about a couple of months ago, you know, I took a few people and drove around that fence area, the Fort Hills, the fence that's right next to the Manzano area. And I drove by that house, and I think there was the sons were visiting their mother.
Oh, on Wagon Train Drive?
That's right.
Yeah, I've been by that house a few times. Yes, Cindy, I think, is her name.
Yes,
is his wife's name. She Cindy. Still lives there, and she's very old. I don't know what her health is like. But in a lot of ways, like you said, if it wasn't for Benowitz, a lot of the stuff wouldn't have started. Of course, John Lear, who we've talked about, went and visited him later, and I think ended up talking to some of the same people that Benowitz was getting his information from, and spread that even a little bit more through his through whatever means he had, through the radio, and I guess by mail at first, and then by the internet later. But yeah, he was involved in that early on. What did you ever have any contact with Lear besides that first thing with the Japanese crew, or did that continue for a while? And what did you think of him?
Yeah, I was very impressed with Mr. Lear because, you know, we met many times in various conferences, and, you know, I was very impressed with his knowledge of the Nevada test site. I mean, he has an amazing knowledge of the entire test site, and I think he has definitely something that... he knows, but I think some of the things he says, you know, I'm not sure if he purposely says these wild claims, you know, I'm not sure, but he definitely knows something, and, you know, I think it was his, he first learned about Dulce, I think from this lady by the name of Ann West. And Ann West knew Tal Levesque, and because Tal Levesque came to my house in 1988 and started talking about Dulce and Area 51, of course, but, you know, he showed me this drawing, I think apparently originally drawn by Ann West. And Tal Levesque told me that he used to live in Santa Fe in 1979 or something, and he met this person that was working at a private security company in Santa Fe, and he got to know this guy, and this guy told him that before he worked and met Tal Levesque, he told Tal Levesque that he used to work in a secret base called Dulce.
Oh, is this Costello?
Yeah, that's right. That is the what Tom that Tal Levesque told me, and you know, but that is Tal Levesque's you know introduction to me of Thomas E. Costello and all these legends. And but you know, but there was apparently Anne West also knew Tal Levesque, or got to know Tal Levesque later, and then John Lear visited New Mexico many times and got to know Anne West, and so he got some information about Dulce from all these people. So, you know, it's a fascinating, all of this is very fascinating, you know, lore. You know, you don't have any physical proof of any of this, but, you know, the rumors persist even to this day. And so much so that it has become a legend. And, yeah, it's just like Area 51. I mean, both Area 51 and Dulce are one of the two most popular topics in ufology among many ufologists. And, of course, Roswell, too. But,
of course.
You know, yeah, but, you know, Dulce is more interesting in... than Roswell, because Roswell is, you know, it's about 1947.
Yeah.
But the Dulce is about, it's ongoing.
Yeah, it's sort of ongoing. I haven't heard too much about it recently. And when we did the conference, I had started to change my mind, thinking there was maybe something there. And then, of course, Michael Sala, in his usual way, did a report and said that I had changed my mind and believed there were aliens there and everything. Like, I did not say anything like that. All I said was, I think there might be something there and might be something to the rumors. Now, that doesn't mean there's aliens there and there was a fight underground and there were growing human body parts and vats and all that, which I guess I can explain, but you're the guest. What do you think started that rumor? What do you think is there and what do you think is going on there now?
Well, as I said, Greg, I think there's not a single tangible physical solid irrefutable documentary evidence whatsoever that there's a physical underground base in Dulce or Archuleta Mesa or Archuleta Mountain, you know. But there are circumstantial evidence that tell us that something has been going on, and this is a fact. The fact is that in 1967, the United States government exploded a nuclear device near Dulce, New Mexico, you know, the Project Gas Buggy. And to me, yes, I think there has been a possibility to me that probably some kind of radiation problem started happening after that explosion. And, you know, in the mid-70s, I think... you know, maybe radiation got, you know, affecting some animals there. But, you know, talking to Gabe Valdez, I think he also believes that the Project Gas Buggy does play a very important role in the origins of the Dulce base. But, of course, Gabe Valdez does believe that there's nothing alien about Dulce. That if there's anything alien about Dulce, that is just a staging or creation of that you know, concept, purposely done by somebody to you know, detract attention away from the real reality of Dulce. And the real reality of Dulce is, to me, that there is a problem. There has been a problem with fertility among young women in the Dulce area for many years.
Since when?
I think it's since, you know, like in the late 70s. And so they say that, you know, there's a rate of cancer in that area that is quite significant, according to some doctors in Farmington who visit Dulce. So, you know, the other possibility is that, you know, Dulce, of course, is under the jurisdiction of the Jicarilla Apache Nation.
Yeah.
And that is one advantage for any government-based, you know, programs that they may conduct at Native American areas, because, you know, they can do things that otherwise won't be able to do in regular, you know, public land in the United States. And one example that comes to my mind is the Cabazon Indian Reservation in California. Because in the early 80s, I think in the Cabazon Indian Reservations, I think there was some kind of a deal with the Native American tribe and Cabazon tribe and the United States government to conduct certain kind of, you know, experiments involving fuel, air, explosives, and other things.
Yeah, well, that was in Ken Thomas's book, The Octopus. Actually, Ken is listening to us right now.
I see. Yes, I was very impressed with his, you know, take on all of this. It's a very important, you know, chapter in the whole history of the possible use of, you know, Indian reservations to conduct anything. You know, the accountability will be difficult to, you know, to approach in this kind of environment. So, you know, actually, there was a magazine that was published in Los Angeles in 90s, called The Technical Consultant. And this magazine had an article about, you know, Michael Riconosciuto and his involvement in the, you know, Inslow scandal and the Cabazon Indian Reservation and,
yeah,
and all kinds of related subject matter. And in that article, strangely enough, Dulce, New Mexico was mentioned.
Really? In what context did they refer to Dulce?
Well, Dulce, New Mexico was mentioned as one another place where government was doing some kind of you know, experiment. And but anyway, you know, I was it was very interesting because this technical consultant magazine, I think they closed up a few years later. But that was the first magazine that mentioned Dulce, New Mexico, just out of the blue, you know, and, you know, talking about Cabazon Indian Reservation and Wackenhut Security System and so on. It was a fascinating article, but Dulce, New Mexico was just mentioned out of the blue for only one paragraph. And in fact, the author of that technical consultant magazine, actually telephoned the Hickory Apache office and asked them a question whether there is a military operations in Dulce, and he was actually shocked to hear from the person that answered in their office never to mention this to anybody or something like that.
You mean they didn't want to answer and don't talk about it and
that's right.
And shut up, yeah.
That was a very interesting article that appeared. I think it was in 1991 or so, 1991 or 1992, I forgot. But that technical consultant magazine also wrote an article 1 year later, I think, about the conference that actually Gary Schultz and I organized in Arcadia, I think in late 1991 or 1992.
Yes, where this naval intelligence guy and his friends showed up.
Yes, there was a guy named Michael Younger,
yes,
who was a mysterious person to me, and he promoted this conference. And he actually, I think he organized the whole conference. Gary Schultz and I were just, you know, program coordinators, but Michael Younger was the one who took initiative in everything. He arranged for the conference, and he arranged for actually speakers. And in this Arcadia conference, this was actually an exposure of the Wackenhut security company. And the Wackenhut's role in black operations, and, you know, this conference was attended by about 200 people. And, you know, Michael Younger basically, it was like almost like an MC. And he introduced various people, he introduced the speech. But among the attendees were Ted Gunderson, and then there was a guy by the name of George Pender. Somebody said that George Pender was part of NSA. But anyway, there was Bob Nichols, or Robert Booth Nichols, who used to work for Wackenhut, I believe, and he was in attendance. And, you know, the whole conference was about exposing Wackenhut. And there were a lot of interesting people among the attendees.
I think that maybe I've heard about this conference. It's legendary. I wish I had been there. I probably wouldn't have known what the hell was going on. But it sounds like, and did you know that I found out with Richard Saraday that Mike Younger was not really who he said he was, and he wasn't in naval intelligence or anything like that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not really familiar with, you know, any person that actually investigated Michael Younger in depth. But Michael Younger, who is no longer here, of course, he died of a heart attack, I think, 10 years ago or something.
Yeah.
But Michael Younger met me in Hilton Hotel by the airport, I think in 1991, when I was speaking about Area 51. After the lecture, this gentleman, who identified himself as Mike Younger, actually, he got to know me, and he handed me a copy of the International Defense Review, IDR magazine, and he pointed out to me some pictures in that, you know, articles. But he befriended me, and he came to my house many times, and I was impressed. Both Gary Schultz and I were very impressed with this person.
Yeah, so was I, and it turns out he was a fake.
Well,
but
that's,
the funny thing is he knew things that fakes shouldn't know. So he had a connection somewhere.
Yeah, and, you know, later on, after a few years, I began to think that maybe this guy is just a plumber or somebody that just pretended or enjoyed pretending to be, you know, a Delta Force officer or somebody. And he even started talking about the COM-12. He said he was a representative of COM-12.
Navy.
Yes. And so, you know, we began to think that, well, maybe this guy is true, or maybe not. But anyway, even to this day, I have mixed feelings. On one hand, I suspect that he could just have been a regular person that was very much interested in pretending to be an officer, or in pretending to be a spy, or in pretending to be an agent or something. But you know, he was strange in many ways.
Yeah. But the thing was that he was working for somebody else because he knew things. He knew certain things that, like, he would tell Richard, or Richard and I, watch Kosovo next week, because this was during the Kosovo conflict. He'd say, next week, you know, this will happen, or you know, they will announce that there's been action in this area. And he was right. And there was no way somebody that was a house painter or whatever he was would know that. So he knew somebody, and somebody through him was trying to feel out the conspiracy and UFO community and put certain ideas in their heads as well, I believe.
I think you could be right, yeah, because on one hand, yeah, he knew too much. of a lot of things. In fact, a very good example is in 1992, when Gary Schultz and I held this conference in Rachel, Nevada, at the Little Ailey Inn. It was called the Ultimate Seminar in 1992. And, you know, it was about Area 51. And, you know, after the seminar was finished, Michael Younger handed to us or showed us what appeared at that time to be an Air Force document saying that there is going to be a conference, you know, sponsored by these two guys, Gary Schultz and Norio Hayakawa, and they will have a conference, you know, about Area 51 in Rachel. And after that conference, it's possible that some rogue elements of this conference might be agitated and might try to sneak through Area 51. And it was like a warning issue. I think this was dated prior to the conference.
Yeah.
But we first found out after the conference that there was this document. So it was an interesting thing, and it used a language that only a person familiar with the language spoken in the Air Force could have ever written.
Do you still have a copy of that, or did he just show it to you?
Well, I have a I don't have a copy of it in my hands, but it is in the Internet. I think I placed it in the Internet. It was called a blue fire or something, blue fire bulletin or something, and it has an Air Force, entitled, you know, on the mark on the top, but it's written almost as if it's really the thing, you know. It is written in language that that only a person that's familiar with the Air Force, language, could have written. It could have been a fake document, or it could have some validity to it. And in fact, I think somehow that warning called the Blue Fire somehow got into the Internet, and somehow you can find that document in Stephen Greer's, I think, book on disclosure at the index or at the end of the book. I think it mentions and it has the copy of that document.
Oh, okay. I've got to find it now then, because I haven't seen that. I'd like Walter to see it, see what he thinks about it, but we can't do it right this minute. I've got listeners writing to me and saying, please talk about Ted Gunderson.
Yes,
because you've been posting a lot about
him. That is a very, very important subject, because, I have been involved with Ted Gunderson since 1995, when I got to know him, because in 1995, Ted Gunderson was speaking at a rally in Palm Springs in 1995 after the Oklahoma bombing incident. I think this was in May that the conference was held, and it was a huge conference about and I think it was the beginning of the so-called Patriot Militia Movement. And this conference was held at a hotel in Palm Springs, and I attended that conference, and that was the first time I heard of Ted Gunderson. I have to reverse that. Ted Gunderson was in attendance in 1992 at a conference in Arcadia, but I didn't know him too well.
Oh, that's right.
But
you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Maybe you ought to tell people that who Gunderson is and... Yeah, because Walter's saying, who's Ted Gunderson? I think there's some people listening who would not know who he is.
Yeah, Ted Gunderson is a person that was the chief agent in charge of Los Angeles and Memphis for many, many years. He retired in 1979, and as the FBI special agent in charge of the entire Los Angeles. He had about 700 people working under him. And actually, in the Olympics in Los Angeles, they asked Ted Gunderson to, you know, take care of the security matters. But he retired in 1979, and later on, he began to look at things, and he began investigating things like the 1993, Waco incident, and then, of course, the 1995, Oklahoma bombing incident, and then, of course, the Ruby Ridge incident, and he began to suspect that there's something wrong about the all of this, and he later on became a promoter of the militia movement and the patriot movement, and he began to be a conspiracy person that began to say that everything, the CIA and FBI and all of them are working, in secrecy. So anyway, naturally, after 1995, I became close to Ted Gunderson through a guy by the name of Anthony J. Hilder in Los Angeles.
Yes, we know who Hilder is.
Yes, who is perceived to be an agitator of conspiracies. actually, I am friends with Anthony Hilder. I've been friends with him since Gary Schultz introduced me to him in 1991.
Yeah.
And ever since 1991, Anthony Hilder and I have been very close. We've done several videos together about, Area 51 and the government's, probable secret program to stage a fake extraterrestrial situation to create a panic and to create a new world order by force, and to create a false, threat, alien threat. And so Anthony Hilder and I have been very close for many, many years. Even today, I occasionally call him. But that does not mean that I believe in Anthony Hilder, and I still don't know for sure what he really is, who he really is. The same with Ted Gunderson. Now, because Ted Gunderson to me is a very, very kind gentleman and a very, very kind-hearted person and very polite and very likable fellow. He's never arrogant at all. And in fact, Ted Gunderson was present at the Area 51 People's Rally in 1999. And Ted Gunderson appeared in several conspiracy conferences along with me. But that does not mean that I, know who he really is. And so, Greg, I try to keep an open mind on things, that there are some people who claim that maybe Ted Gunderson may not be who he really is.
You posted about that today.
Yes, so the same with Anthony Hilder. Anthony Hilder, I have no idea how he makes a living, but he goes to London and he goes to this place and that and talking about, conspiracies and Illuminati and all these things. That he does that 24/7, and I have no idea where his finance comes from. So, regardless of this, I keep a friendship with Anthony Hilder, and Anthony Hilder knows Ted Gunderson very, very well. Of course, Ted Gunderson is awfully sick, and I think the last time Ted Gunderson was conscious, from what I hear, was July 3rd. He's dying of cancer. And so There has been a lot of speculations recently about who Ted Gundersen was. So some people say he was an imposter, that the real Ted Gundersen died a long time ago, and so on. So it's a fascinating thing, you know. But there has been a smear campaign against Ted Gundersen, or at least the person who claims to be Ted Gundersen. And, you know, Ted Gundersen, I'm not sure if you remember this, but he was involved in a lawsuit, you know, with Art Bell.
Yes.
And the main reason that Art Bell left his program, one of the main reasons was because of that scandal. I think, I'm not sure what year that was, 1997, or I'm not sure. Well, maybe, I'm not sure what year, it's the year 1999, I'm not sure, but a scandal came upon Art Bell, and that scandal involved allegations by Ted Gundersen and so on. And so, you know, it's a very, 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 very fascinating topic, Ted Gundersen himself. You know, some people say that he was, you know, part of the COINTELPRO, you know.
Yeah, there was. I started to watch the video with him explaining what the charges were with against him from Art Bell and his lawyers, but the thing was so damn long, I just didn't want to watch it. I mean, part one was an hour long, and there were like five parts to it.
I see.
So maybe you can summarize for us what people said Ted Gundersen did to defame Art Bell, and what his defense was, and if you think it's even really an issue.
You know, it may be a small thing, but Ted Gundersen claimed that there was a network of, you know, politicians in Washington in the 80s and maybe 90s that were involved in, you know, child pornography and all this these terrible things. And Ted Gundersen claimed that he began to investigate all these groups, you know, that you know, were involved in pedophiles and so on, all these things. And Ted Gundersen, you know, started investigating all of this, and then somehow Ted Gundersen got information that you know, Art Bell was also somehow involved in this. And, you know, this became a huge scandal, and a lawsuit was filed by Art Bell, and somehow it ended up. And I'm not sure that if they settled out of court, but I think because of this scandal, Art Bell, a lot of people say, got tired of this and quit, you know, his radio show. But Ted Gunderson's role... And even though I say that Ted Gundersen may not necessarily be the Ted Gundersen, the real Ted Gundersen, or he could be the real Ted Gundersen, but he could well have been manipulated by the FBI itself, because the FBI never condemned Ted Gundersen. Despite Ted Gundersen appearing in so many talk radio shows and producing lots of, you know, videos with Anthony Hiller, the FBI or the CIA never once condemned Ted Gundersen for what he has been doing. So this is very something strange.
Well, either there's a bunch of possibilities here. One, he's doing what he's supposed to do. Two, what he's doing is not really that important and nobody's paying any attention to it. Or three, he's totally nuts and nobody pays any attention to him anyway.
Yeah, so, you know, this is all just
I bet it's a mixture of a lot of these things. And you know, some
could be a mixture.
Yeah, probably... To me, the least amount is any kind of official control, kind of like, well, let them go nuts because nobody's listening to them anyway. And the pedophile angle, that was also a part of, did he contribute to that Franklin cover-up book that came out?
Yes, that's right. I think he also investigated that Franklin cover-up and so on, you know, and he was very involved in this thing. And actually, he was involved in the McMartin case. I think it's in Los Angeles. In the there was a scandal
Yeah, his idea was that it was a real scandal and the people were acquitted because of the false memory thing, and that was because the False Memory Syndrome Foundation was started and run by CIA operatives trying to get these people off, and it becomes more and more complicated, and which is part of the reason why I stopped paying attention to these things, because they're so complicated and so speculative in a lot of cases that it's hard to follow it, and... you know, I don't know if there were false memories involved. Possibly that became the official story, but who knows? And who knows? I mean, these things were also in books like Transformation of America by Kathy O'Brien, the same kind of accusations, which I don't know if are true or not. And, you know, it's kind of fun. I don't know. It's kind of fun, but it's kind of fun and frightening and horrifying to think that it actually does happen. And I think to some extent it probably does. But I think there's a lot of misdirection of researchers and misdirection of people that are interested in this subject matter to keep them basically running in circles and not really investigating what might be really important and what might not even be what they think they're looking at. It's covering up something completely different that has to do with power and money and not with pedophilia and all that.
Exactly. And the same goes... with the world of ufology. That's why my policy has always been be open-minded, but up to a certain point, and of course, but not make any dogmatic statements about certain things, because we just don't know. But psychological point of view, this is a fascinating world. The whole world of ufology. And sometimes I think that Bill Cooper was right in a sense that when he left ufology, basically, I think in the mid-90s, and when he left ufology, he created the word called ufology. And I got a laugh at that, when he created this word, ufology, because and then he started accusing everybody in ufology as agents that were against him and so on, but anyway.
Well, classic paranoid stuff. It's as soon as you don't agree with somebody, they're agents plotting against you.
Exactly. That's a very, very common practice of some ufologists that have, very off-tangent, things.
Well, there's a signal-to-noise thing here, I think. And sometimes the noise just gets so much you can't figure out what the signal is anymore. And I think that Cooper, for whatever you think about him, I think the noise ratio on him was so high that only the most insane people or people that were excited by paranoia would listen to him after a while. And if there was any signal in there, anything, any truth in there, it's just so covered up with so much other junk that it's hard to take. And I think that's how most people feel about conspiracy research and about UFO research. People that aren't in it, even some people that are in it, because they're looking for answers, and egos and belief systems and all get wrapped up in it. And what you get is a jumble of nonsense, and most people don't have the time or the patience or the sanity to try and separate all that out.
Yes, you're right. That's why, I like your stance, Greg, that, you look at things from a very right perspective, and I think that's very good, because, we're talking about human nature and, the humanity and the, characteristics of humans, and it's all part of a learning process, I think, and we'll go on and on, and I think it depends on how you control personally all of these things, and how you make a distinction, and how you sustain middle, and how you put your, 2 feet on, while at the same time being open to things, This is why it's so important for us to put our 2 feet on the ground, keep putting the 2 feet on the ground, and while at the same time being open-minded enough to, accept that there are, could be alternative explanations to everything. You're one of the most level-headed researchers that I've ever known. So I really appreciate what you're doing. I like your stance, easygoing stance, and, your very open-mindedness your discretion, too. And so, I like to be like yourself. In the 90s, I was very, not really mature in ufology because I was, may have been lopsided and, in the last few years, I have come to look at everything from a wide perspective and not come to any conclusions, hasty conclusions, but, it's important to continue to be in this whole phenomenon, because this whole phenomenon is what life is all about. Right? It has everything to do with place in the cosmos, and so I think that's how I want to be known as a person that looks things from a wide perspective.
There's another component to that too, that it's, if you want to stay interested, it's the only way you can really stay sane, is to get that filtering going and maybe accept everything that seems to be interesting, or at least consider it, but like you said, make no conclusions really. And also you have to be okay that you may never get an answer or may never have a conclusion. Because the people that come to conclusions, they stop thinking, and they start defending their position to the point where it's, at some point they're going to start to look silly in a lot of cases, even though everybody knows that they're wrong. They can't see it anymore because they've shut down their learning process.
Exactly. And this is why I said time and time again that, I have learned so much about life from being a long-time funeral director. Because I learned about life, and I learned about what people think, and, it's very important. And then also it's important to have a wide range of interest, in many fields, in languages and in arts and, ufology, music. So it's very interesting, and it's very important to have a wide scope of cosmos and interest. And, so I feel very privileged that I have been able to enjoy these things in life from wide, wide perspective. Even being a Japanese guy, I bring my Japanese culture as well and Japanese way of looking at things. And so, I'm really privileged in many sense. But I think the reason I really admire you, Greg, is because you have the same background, basically, and I think you told me that your mother is very, very specialist in the Japanese, art of the
tea ceremony.
Oh yes, that's right.
You may not know this, Norio, but I'm actually taking tea ceremony lessons now.
Oh, that is tremendous.
And the funny thing is, people ask me what it's like. And my answer is, it's like martial arts without the fighting.
Exactly. It's really, all these arts, I think, are just amazing. Even the art of tea is such a wide range of discipline, and it's an art. Just like flower arrangement, it's not just a matter of arranging flowers, but no. All these ancient arts, especially of the Orient, like the Japanese culture, is very interesting, and it's quieting, it's calming, and it make it creates discipline. And so, you know, I'm glad that I have I bring that kind of a culture, and just like you, and you know, I think it's tremendous. And you know, I'm interested in all kinds of you know, culture and philosophy, and even things like Buddhism very much interests me, because it's not about religion, it's about the way of life. So yeah, I'm interested in all of this.
Well, you also have an interest, and you're pretty good at some at music, and you, and it turns out we have some I was totally surprised to find out we have a mutual interest in both country music and Japanese guitarists.
Yes, I was so surprised, you know, that you were a fan of this Terauchi Takeshi guitarist in Japan. He is a great guitarist.
Yeah, I've played that on my show, some of his stuff, and I've gotten great comments. People love it. We have got 3 minutes left, Norio. Is there anything else you wanted to say, or some way you wanted to promote yourself or upcoming appearances or anything like that? And then I'll play one of your the tracks of music that you've sent me here. Because, like you said in the beginning, he performs music at a lot of places in New Mexico.
Yeah, thank you so much, Greg. It has been a great pleasure to be on your very, very relaxing program. This is one of the most important things. You know, most programs are not relaxing, but your program definitely is relaxing program. That's what's important. And but anyway, thank you so much. I have nothing to sell. I have no videos to sell, no books to sell. I don't have anything to sell.
Wonderful.
But information freely given. That's my policy. But anyway, I gotta go now. But you know, thank you so much, Greg, for and Walter, you know, for having me in your program.
Well, it's nice to meet you, Norio. Finally.
Okay, I'll.
Okay, Norio, thanks
thank
so
you.
Much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
There's a hang-up noise for Skype. I'm going to play this one bit of music by Norio Hayakawa, which is titled Showdown at Dulce, New Mexico, I think.
This is by Norio?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
He plays the keyboards.
Right, okay.
So I'm going to play this and then probably something from Takeshi Terauchi and the Bunnies. Incredible guitarist. He's still alive. He was one of those group of one of those people that in Japan that went nuts and started playing guitar music after the Ventures toured Japan, I believe in 1966 or something like that. They spawned an entire wave of instrumental guitar music.
Really?
Just by appearing in Japan, and the band Takeshi Terauchi and his group the Bunnies did some incredible work, and he's been doing stuff since then. I for all I know, he still plays. Maybe somebody can get him to come here and play. But this is by Norio. It's called Showdown at Dulce, New Mexico. It's about 3 minutes. And then we'll say bye. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next. Oh, no, I won't be here next week. I'm going to the Devil's Gate outing with Adam Gorightly, Skyler, few other people. Mike Marinacci, I believe, is coming. A bunch of people that have been on this show are going to be at this outing. We're going to be out there all night. So
Night?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I was afraid I was going to miss it because I'm going to be coming home from Comic-Con. But
it starts at 5 in the evening.
But you're going to be out there all night?
Yeah.
I might meet up with you guys afterwards, after I get back.
Oh, okay.
And drop some people off.
So what will happen is I think I'm going to try and get somebody to put a old show up off the archive here. And if not, I will. Nick Redfern was actually going to be on the show, so I will post the show at the Roddy Mysterioso site that I did with him a couple of months ago when the server wasn't working, an interview about his Contactees book. I think it was about... No, Final Events. It was about the Final Events book. And so if you want to hear my interview with him about that, that will be up probably Friday or Saturday of this next week. And our interview here, our great interview, I had a lot of fun talking with Norio. That will be up in a couple of days here, maybe even tomorrow at Roddy Mysterio. So meanwhile, here's Showdown at Dulce, New Mexico by our guest, Norio Hayakawa. Gabe's still doing stuff. Let's hear one more by Takashi Teruji and the Bunnies. Oh, this is interesting. In a Persian market. Very, very good version of this.